Marga Lauber, thanks for coming on the show today. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Shane. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited for our conversation today. You've recently come out with a book called Agents of Evolution, and it's about how, you know, you use the framework of astrology and, you know, you incorporate some ideas of like animism and really interesting topics to describe how living in our world today and the various transformations that we as people, as individuals, and as a society go through, and, you know, what it means and how we can better equip ourselves to understand and progress through at a sort of good way, a good way of doing it, right? Change isn't that bad. So we're going to talk about that. And, you know, I'm a fan of animism. I think it's a tremendously interesting philosophy, or however you want to characterize it. And it doesn't really get that much attention these days. So it's good to have a place to talk about it.
Indeed. So,
I mean, how about we just sort of like start there? Like, you know, how can you give a little explanation about what animism is and animistic psychology and what that sort of means for you and how you came about it?
Yeah, so animism is essentially the idea that every animate thing on Earth has presence, has awareness, and can be treated as a human. So even beyond humans, you know, that dogs have awareness, the wind has awareness, that the mountains have awareness, that rocks have awareness, and that we are in relationship with all of these beings. So it's a way of being in relatedness to all of life, all of, you know, everything that we experience on Earth, as, you know, having the same rights and value as humans do.
Right. So it's kind of like the idea that, you know, the whole world, or the whole universe, if you want to go that big, has a sort of central essence to it, right? And every little thing has a necessary component to that. And if you look at the sort of universal essence, or the universal soul, however you would like to characterize it, you look at that and you say, well, this is life, right? And so there is life, and there is consciousness and awareness in everything that is manifested in, you know, how we sort of perceive and interact with our physical, so-called physical world, right? And it's interesting because usually, you know, in the sort of society that we have these days, we tend to, as humans, separate ourselves from the rest of things rather arbitrarily. I mean, understandably so. In the sense of, like, we think we're sort of above and beyond the natural order of things, right? And it's really just, I don't know, maybe it's a bit of an oversight in the sense of, like, yeah, but we're so involved and integrated into everything in life. I mean, you know, we're evolved to live on this planet in exactly this atmosphere with, you know, the various rhythms of the world and of ourselves, and you can't just sort of separate ourselves from that. I mean, the food that we eat and we need to survive has to come from this place, and the way we interact and behave and breathe and live, you know, it's all so interconnected. And then we kind of go, yeah, but I can think now, so I'm above nature, right? It's
right.
Just a funny way of looking at it, don't you think?
It is funny, and I agree, arbitrary. You know, maybe because we have minds and the capacity to think and to speak and to reason, we think we're above the rest. Maybe we've gotten that idea. I think it, you know, somewhere in the 1600s, historically, when, you know, the age of reason really started to come about and scientific method and, you know, scientific inquiry came about, you know, there was a shift from the natural world as being, you know, part of what, you know, us within the natural world as, you know, one kind of unit, as scientific reason started to take hold, which, you know, brought us some really incredible things. Obviously, you and I are speaking, you know, through technology. None of what all the conveniences that we have and all of the learning that we've, you know, the advancements that we've had in science and medicine, all of it, you know, it wouldn't be here without that shift that took place. However, I think that it created in us this idea that we are separate, that because we have this capacity to reason and to manipulate our environments, to create weapons, you know, that somehow that makes us better. And it's kind of, as you pointed out, it's a fallacy, because we're dependent on the rest of, you know, this world. We're dependent on the trees for oxygen. We're dependent on the food chain for our food, you know. So it's a fallacy to think that we're separate, but we think that way anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it is very interesting, because, like, you know, you think about, we make this sort of arbitrary distinction between natural and artificial a lot of the time, right? And thinking of ourselves as the artificial interferer of evolution and with nature. And to some degree, you know, there's a logic to that. But really, I mean, it's like, you know, if you look at, I think about it like this, right? Like, if you look at a beehive, right? You don't look at the bees who built this beehive and go, well, the beehive isn't naturally occurring, right? So that's an artificial structure. People don't really talk about that. We talk about natural beehives. And so why are the buildings that we live in considered artificial and not natural, when really it's the same sort of process of just gathering the necessary construction materials, whatever they may be, and, you know, working together to build the structure that, you know, the creatures can live in, whether it's us or the bees, right?
100% agree. And it's almost as if the only difference is that bees do it well, and we do it very arbitrarily. Bees do it in harmony with the environment, and you know, in a way that allows all the natural processes to continue in balance and unabated, whereas we do seem to interject certain artificial, I mean, that's kind of an interesting word, but some ineffective, we introduce some ineffective, you know, in our building, we introduce ineffective ways of interacting with the environment, you know, materials that are, you know, not easily replenished, or ways that interfere with other ecosystem members, you know? So yeah, I agree. I think bees, we could learn a lot from the bees in terms of building.
Yeah, I think we could learn a lot from most of nature if we just pay enough attention to it, right? But it is weird that we do consider ourselves outside of the sort of natural ecosystem of the world, right? And I guess a lot of it is to do with the fact that these days, you know, we spend most of our time, if you live at least in a sort of sizable enough city, you know, you spend most of your time indoors. I live in Canada, so most of the year is indoors because the weather's a little bit unforgiving at times. And so you spend your time indoors with screens. You're surrounded by mostly just people. Maybe you have some pets, which is the best. But, you know, so you kind of isolate. We isolate ourselves from the rest of nature, right? And I think that plays a part in sort of seeing ourselves as separate and different. And we tend to kind of like look at the rest of the natural order of things as like things we can do or use it for, right? Not just what is its place in existence, right?
Right. There's this idea of biomimicry, you know, where learning specifically from nature to mimic its, you know, natural processes in our human lives. And I think it's a really necessary way of approaching the problems in front of us right now, is, you know, to look at how does the natural world do it. This isolation in particular that you speak of, you know, I think that comes from our our want to increase our own lifespans, you know, so we have heat, we have all the convenience, we have, you know, air conditioning in hotter climates. We have all the conveniences that allow us to be really comfortable and to live longer, you know, what medicine has done for us. But
yeah.
is that really in harmony with the rest of the natural processes around us? You know, what are we interfering with as we increase our own lifespans and, you know, sort of hoard materials and, you know, do just what we want with building and without consideration for waterways or air pollution, you know? So biomimicry, yeah, I think, is one of the ways that we can start to orient ourselves towards solving some of these problems that we are creating.
Right. It is interesting because it's like, you know, no one has really deliberately constructed it this way, right? It's just a consequence of the advancement of our civilization and the need for resources according to that civilization, how in order to survive and continue our way of life as it is, right? And so it's not like people are going out and being like, I want to destroy the planet and fuck shit up, you know? It's like, that's not happening. People are just being like, well, yeah, we use all of these products and there's a huge market for it and there's so many people in the world. And so you can use that and be like, okay, well, I want these trees to, we need to cut down these trees to make all of our paper products, or, you know, use like oil to make so many things in our lives. I mean, you know, were our oil wells to completely shut down, I mean, it would crush civilization, right? We'd have zero transport at this point in time. I mean, maybe, you know, the electric industry is up and coming and that's great to some degree, but something's got to provide that electricity, and, you know, the battery storages are a problem. And it's like, there's no clear answer of like how we can address all of these very complex issues simply, right? But I think we are at least trying now more than perhaps before to try and address some of these big problems that we're facing. But what's interesting, you know, when I was reading your stuff, it was like you had this point where you were explaining that in transformation and like an evolutionary transformation, like if you want to change the world, you got to start by changing yourself, right?
Correct.
And that idea has come in many forms for probably thousands of years,
yeah,
right? And why do you think it is that we feel this like individual responsibility for our sort of collective environment, mm-hmm, and sort of project our energy outside of ourselves? Do you think it's because it's easier to do that instead of being like, well, maybe all this shit that I'm suffering is coming from inside me? It's easier to be like, it's the world that's the problem. Let me make all this great effort to try and fix that, and then maybe I'll be a little happier. Do you think like that's kind of where it comes from, or what?
That's a really great inquiry. My sense is it comes from our sense of being separate. Hmm. You know, that rather than knowing that I am a microcosm of this larger macrocosm, and that what happens in me happens in the rest of the macrocosm, we think there's me and the world. And, mm-hmm, you know, shit is going wrong because the world is screwing up. And yeah, so I got to go out there and make things better. I think it's an innocent mistake. You know, like you said, I don't think we're doing this on purpose. Mm-hmm. I don't think things got this way because of evil. I think, yeah, we're just making some innocent mistakes. We're you know, wanting to live well, and but we lose track, and this is where, to me, evolution comes in, individual evolution comes in. We lose track, or we lose connection with the awareness, the understanding that we actually are a microcosm of the entire world that we live in. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, that too is not a new idea. That's, you know, so many religions and spiritualities for thousands of years have expounded on that idea, yeah, and really lived it. I think we are maybe in the past few centuries the first ones to not live it, you know, to not understand that, to really depart from that idea. So when we're, if I can come back to that, not just intellectual idea, but real felt sense that, you know, I am not separate from this world. In fact, the world is in me. Mm-hmm. That's a big statement, you know, but when one can really come into that felt sense, into that experiential awareness that the world is in me, I'm not separate from the world, then I don't need to go out there to, I mean, I still may do my social activist work or, you know, work to make things, you know, make things good out there in whatever way possible. But I'm not kidding myself that without doing my own work, that something else out there is going to have any effect.
Right. Or it'll just be mostly like a distraction, right? You can distract yourself from your internal world by projecting everything outside and just focusing on that. But, you know, that kind of is just one step. I mean, you're not going to get very far doing that. Although, I don't know, maybe some people do that all their lives and they try and try and try and it doesn't work and then they die and then, you know, someone else starts again.
Yeah, or they reincarnate. Who knows?
Yeah. Keep trying.
That's right. Well, that's
like, I didn't get it that time. I need to go again.
Give me another chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like your point. And I do want to frame the conversation in this way that it's not like we're doing something horrible and we as humans have utterly failed and we've become these evil, twisted monsters that are ruining the planet. I do think it's an innocent mistake. And that by acknowledging, oh, right, there's a different way to move through this world, it's sort of like waking up to something that we just innocently kind of lost sight of or lost connection with.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, it also has to do with the fact that people have far more power over things these days than they might have in the past, or at least there's more of them. In the sense of like, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's just how it is, right? In our society, that's where we've gotten to. But, you know, you kind of like take a step back from trying to assign blame to any individual person. And you kind of can just look at any person who, you know, you might think is causing problems and you kind of look at what they're doing. And it's like, yeah, they're just trying to live their life and do what they're trying to do, you know? And it's unfortunate, I suppose, in some sense that their actions are having these kinds of consequences, but they're not actively trying to do that. They're just trying to, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, maybe it's a silly analogy, but it's like if you look at the sort of like a CEO of a big company, right, who has relative power over quite a lot of people and influence in things, and you look at them and they make decisions and those decisions affect people directly, right? All the people that work for them and the companies that they interact with or whatever it is they do. And it's like you go and you actually talk to that person instead of just, you know, keeping them with their decisions and being like, this is the whole person. You talk to the person and you're like, oh, they're just trying to live their life and do their job and, you know, make all the people around them happy. So they're trying to appease the board of directors and, you know, the people who are funding everything. And, you know, so decisions get like the gray area of like morality might come into play because what's more important to the company. And, you know, it's just like all these very complicated things that we kind of see the results of and just say, oh, well, that was an evil thing to do. Right. I mean, I guess to some degree, I mean, this is more of a philosophical question about good and evil. But there, you know, you would want to say that there certainly are like evil people, in the world, like, you know, the dictators that have committed genocide and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a little bit hard to be like, nah, they're just chilling or whatever. I mean,
I really hear your point. Yeah. Yeah. I do hear your point, but I prefer to think of it in terms of dark and light rather than evil and good. And again, to come back to that, idea that the world is in me, that darkness is in me as well. And so is the light. Like I'm not separate from those dictators. I'm not separate from the saints. Those both exist in me. And so when I can stop projecting, you know, like you were saying, stop projecting blame elsewhere, you know, I just start taking ownership of what needs to change right here, right now, today, right in this moment, then I've made already a significant contribution.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair enough, right? And I think that the dark and light way of putting it probably is easier to sort of wrap my head around, because we're not, you know, good and evil have such enormous connotations to them, right? Like the word God, for example, does as well. And it's like, yeah, but if you kind of just look past that and look at what the essence is trying to communicate in that word or in that phrase, then you can kind of start to reimagine what's trying to be communicated, right? And so I agree with you on that point. I think that's fair enough. But so, you know, you were saying, like, in terms of the fact that we all have darkness and light inside of us, right? Mm. Now, what's the right way to try and, like, come to contend with these forces or these paradigms inside of us without it, you know, being too crazy? Like, how do you delve into the darkness, right, skillfully? Mm.
It's a great inquiry. My sense with darkness, and in the book, I sort of speak about this a little bit in the Saturn chapter. You know, we have a choice in every moment. We always have choice, and you know, the point isn't to always choose light. Mm-hmm. This universe wouldn't exist without the darkness. I'm saying some very big things that I don't know how practical this is, but I'll just say, you know, just to give you my viewpoint, I feel that, you know, darkness is actually just a part of life. You know, there isn't a way to escape it entirely. And in mm-hmm. fact, I feel that some of the problem with some of the world's major religions is the denying of the darkness and kind of pushing it away and saying, I am nothing but pure good. I'm nothing but pure light. It's out there. The darkness is out there and I'm going to keep it out. And that right. doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work. We've seen where that leads us. So my sense, I'm going to bring in another writer named Charles Eisenstein. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He
No.
wrote a book called Sacred Economics. And he's a brilliant thinker. And he just wrote a blog post that I was just fascinated with. He talked about how the Star Wars series, you know, kind of has this, is this old sort of myth of the mm-hmm. good versus the evil, like the Jedi are good, the Sith are evil. But what if that's just one way of telling the story? What if that is from this level of understanding that there is the good and the bad, and my job is to get on the side of the good and to shoo out the bad? Like that has not worked. We've seen mm-hmm. where that takes us. And in this blog post, he describes how, you know, understanding that darkness is a part of each of us is actually kind of an evolutionary leap that we might make. It's actually something that we might be being called to understand right now. Like the polarization that's happening right now here in the US politically, mm-hmm. is a lot about those guys are evil or those guys have it wrong, you know, and yeah. we're over here doing it right. And that's not taking us anywhere. We're kind of stuck in this polarized way of being, which just keeps breeding more war, more contention, you know, more division. So yeah. to me, there's an evolutionary leap that's required. That is very much what Charles Eisenstein was saying in his last blog post about recognizing the darkness in each of us, doing the shadow work. So to, back to your original question about how do we engage, you know, what is the right way, or what is the right attitude to take toward our own darkness? And to me, it's very much about doing shadow work. It's very much about understanding, yeah, I have a capacity for violence. Yeah, I have a capacity for horrible things. And I have a choice in every moment. Do I want to engage that or not? And by not denying it, I'm giving it a space inside myself. So I'm not having to polarize, you know, I'm not having to create a division, a separation between myself and the rest of the world. So I think it's about, you know, so when I say shadow work, I mean, you know, many different ways of doing it. Some cultures do it through plant medicine. Some cultures like ours do it through talk therapy. Some cultures do, you know, there are many different ways of doing shadow work, but it's essentially encountering our own darker tendencies, not denying them, you know, bringing them into balance in ourselves, and making a choice that is in the best interest of the moment, you know, with the awareness that we are not separate from the rest of anything.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think the word that you used there, which was balance, I think is critical as well, because, you know, it is easy to look at some sort of conflict that's going on and be like, well, which side am I on, right? How do I feel about this? And then which is my team? You know, there's a lot of like, what do they call it? Like in crowd, out crowd kind of division that happens these days with, you know, ideological, political ideologies and all sorts of just like groupings of things. And it's interesting that, you know, excuse me, there is in our world like an obvious like a necessity for duality in the sense of what you were saying in terms of like, yeah, well, you don't have darkness. I mean, you don't have light without darkness, right? You can't have hot without cold. These dualities exist everywhere, right? In nature, in all sorts, life and death. And well, what we consider life and death, let's say at least. And so I, you know, I like what you're saying about, well, it's not our job to say, well, which side am I on, or where do I fit in? It's more about how do I fit in a well-balanced way into this paradigm, right? And so you say, okay, well, there is lightness and darkness within me, let's say, and you know, there's some situation happening, and now I'm going to choose, you know, what's best for this situation. And I guess that's a much better approach than being like, which team should I be on, you know? And therefore, you, by doing so, you kind of automatically ostracize some group of people, whatever it is. I mean, it could even be sports teams. I mean, people kill each other over football matches and, you know, things like that. Like, it's so weirdly in our blood for violence. And I guess it is that, like, propensity that we have towards the dark side of things that we kind of have to come to grips with and integrate that into our personality, right? I mean, that's kind of where the sort of shadow work term comes from, right? I think it was Jung originally who spoke about integrating the dark bits of our personality that we've sort of repressed and shut down and want to leave behind, that keep popping their nose up to be like, hey, you know, I'm still here. Mm-hmm. Like, what if you do this? And sometimes they overrule and we end up in situations we don't want to be in. But it is very interesting. And so in terms of the like evolution of it, like, where do you think that we're sort of headed? What are our sort of options here?
That's the $1 million question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, as an astrologer, you know, I look to the planets and what's happening in the sky now and onward into the next years, decades to answer that question, because as a person, I don't know. I don't have a sense. I mean, things look pretty bleak, honestly, you know, from where I'm standing as a person, but, when you look at the astrology of it, it really does seem that over time we are creating a new kind of order and, you know, new structures that govern us. And that includes political systems as well as economies, you know, so in as much as economies govern us, we're creating those new systems, I believe, over these next, we have been since 2020 and through 2024, there's a real kind of critical moment astrologically mm-hmm. going on in which we are making some really big shifts and changes as a world, you know, as a human family across the globe. And then the next couple decades after that, I feel like we are integrating those changes and, you know, kind of coming to terms with, wow, that changes all these other things like the institution of marriage or the way that families live or the way that communities live together or cooperate with each other or not, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, how isolated or not we are, how much we keep going in the direction of technology or not, you know, so there are all of these questions I think are going to be with us for many decades. But I feel like right now is when we are all making choices. Every single one of us are making choices, and every single one of us has an impact on where this goes. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of one of the, you know, primary premises of the book of Agents of Evolution is it's not going to be big businesses or governments or even NGOs that create these changes that we have to make in order to continue to live, you know, in harmony or in balance on our planet. It's not going to be big structures, big organizations. It's going to be individuals like you and me making decisions about, okay, I guess I could try, you know, living in an intentional community or, you know, whatever it is. Like I'm not saying that there are specific Sure. answers, but whatever it is that each of us, you know, is confronting each of us as we make those decisions, we're making them on behalf of the collective and we have an impact.
Yeah, a huge impact. Yeah. And I think you're right, the top-down approach never really seems to work, right? When you're trying to force people to do things in the name of change, there's like an automatic resistance that happens just to counteract that. And a grassroots approach seems to be the real, you know, way of change, where you're not trying to force different ideas and ways of being on people. You kind of are like, well, if enough people start doing it, then it'll influence everything because those people are part of the society and they'll be conducting themselves in this, you know, new or better way. And as a consequence, their effects will be magnified throughout the society, right? So that will be in the businesses they run, in the positions they hold in office, in their interactions with everyone. And it's definitely important to say that, you know, each person has a significant role to play, even if it doesn't feel like it at times, because, you know, every interaction that you have has the potential to change someone's whole life. I mean, you don't have to necessarily put all that responsibility on yourself, but, you know, you can just think about how someone saying something to you once or you hearing something in conversation had like such a major shift in your perspective on things, even if they weren't really trying to do that. They might have just been expressing something they've been through or done or learnt or whatever it is. And then, you know, it just sort of passes on, right? And so there is a huge thing. And I mean, I'll just say, like, there's this amazing statistic that comes up, which is that, you know, if you know 1,000 people in your life that you interact with regularly, let's say, which is not so many these days. Back in the day, 1,000 was a lot. But these days, you know, if you know 1,000 people and you influence them, let's say, and they influence you, but also you influence them. So you're directly connected to 1,000 people. And if each of those 1,000 have their own 1,000, then you're one person away from 1,000,000 people. And then if each of those million have their own 1,000, then you reach 1,000,000,000. So you're 2 people away from 1,000,000,000 people and 3 people away from the whole world. Mm. Right?
Wow.
And I mean, it's obviously not as straightforward as that, but just that's the idea of the kind of impact that, you know, one person can have on the world. Yeah. And not necessarily for credit either, right? It doesn't, exactly. It's not about like, I did this.
Right.
It's better when you don't take credit, evidently.
Right. And so much of it happens underground, you know, it's like a mom who has like three kids, you know, like she's maybe not doing a whole lot of stuff that's getting her credit in our culture. But with those three children, the impact that she has on them, and then the 1,000 people that they each know, and then, you know, yeah. and then taking that, you know, so it's like each of us has a specific kind of impact. You know, I can't remember who it was that said sphere of influence, you know, each of us has a specific sphere of influence. And that impact is undeniable, you know, within our sphere of influence.
Yeah. And so be nice to people, you know,
yeah.
it makes a difference.
It does.
A little bit of niceness goes a long way.
Yes,
for sure. And kindness. And also to yourself, right? Be good to yourself because you're important.
Yeah. Again, that's where it starts. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so I was actually just going to say, like, it's interesting how as we've kind of disconnected ourselves more and more from the whole, and, you know, we tend to isolate ourselves more in our sort of like mental world, how we tend to suffer a lot more at our own hand, right? In terms of the beliefs and thoughts and ideas that we have both consciously and unconsciously about ourselves, and, you know, how that sort of starts to shape everything as well. Right. And I think this sort of just touches on that same point of like, well, you know, if you're wanting to improve your life and you want to make it better and feel better and be better and do better, like starting with yourself means like an honest evaluation of what's going on. Right. Which is also that shadow work that we were talking about. And so it's interesting that I think more and more people are starting to do that as well. I think in sort of as a counterbalance to this, you know, mass movement away from the connectedness with nature and society, there is a resurgence of this, you know, I don't know, spiritual world or something like that. What do you think?
Yeah, I feel it's always been there, and it kind of comes into the public view off and on, you know, it kind of gains popularity, right. Loses popularity. But it never really goes away, you know, like the ancient spiritual traditions of, you know, Buddhism, for instance, I mean, it's been around for, you know, quite some time, and, the precepts don't change, you know, there is, or Taoism, or, you know, even any of the indigenous kind of spiritualities, like the precepts don't change. They've noticed certain truths about living and being here on this planet that don't change.
Yeah.
So that kind of work, I think, has been going on. I think you're right. It gains popularity. It loses popularity, but it continues to go on with some core group of people on the earth at all times. I don't think it's ever kind of left.
Disappeared.
You know? Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be if it is that, you know, like a primary truth that people discover and then communicate using the tools of their culture to make it more accessible to their people, right? And then it's not easy if you don't come from that culture to sort of look at that and be like, understand exactly what they're saying. I mean, I think it's probably more and more accessible these days as we get exposed and participate in all sorts of new cultures and, you know, can sort of put ourselves in different shoes and see it that way. And have translated versions of everything at the, you know, click of a button. And so from that sense, you know, I think we can access a lot more these days. But it's interesting how to look at the sort of history of religion and spirituality and be like, oh, well, they're kind of all saying the same thing, right? There's one or a few central components that underlie all of it. And it's just some of it's been institutionalized and, you know, taken on a different direction and used not in the way it was intended, and some of it hasn't and has sort of sustained with that sort of essential truth in it, right? And I think that does transcend the cultures as well.
I agree. I think it transcends the cultures because only the, you know, unless a truth is actually perceivable by the person who hears it, it's not going to continue as a truth, you know? Yeah. So like if a precept of Buddhism, if I hear it and I go, well, that's not true for me, I don't get it, it says it, then it's like, it falls, it's done. It's like over, you know? But yeah. for these principles to have continued, there has to be some shred of truth in them. Mm-hmm. And Shane, this is why I wrote this book from a lens of astrology, because even though right now in our culture, it still has a little bit of I think it is gaining popularity by leaps and bounds, you know, over the past 5 years or so, in kind of shocking ways to me, because when I started out, it wasn't, you know, there was kind of a stigma attached to it, like, oh, that's superstition or whatever. But it is a universal sort of thing. Like every culture has their own version of astrology, and there aren't really any cultural things you have to buy into in order for the truth to make sense to you, you know, whereas with a religion, there are these cultural aspects that you have to, if you're not part of the culture, it won't make sense to you. So that's why with Agents of Evolution, I'm writing from this perspective of, you know, viewing things through a lens of astrology, trying to have this conversation about the need for our individual evolution, you know, through this kind of more universal, what I consider to be universal lens.
No, and I think that it's a great approach, because it does transcend everything, right? I mean, okay, you can't really, it's not going to go well if you go in being like, I don't believe in this, so, you know, let's see what it's about. I mean, in anything in life, like, you're not going to get anywhere useful by doing that, right? But you're right that, you know, astrology doesn't have the presuppositions of, like, you have to be born or have gone through all these ceremonies or, you know, be like this or look like this or have these characteristics to be a part of the group that it describes. It's much more of a, like, no, it talks about humans and other things, let's say, but, you know, you're like, you're a human, so you fit under our guidelines. I mean, not guidelines, in the framework.
In the framework, right. And this is where the animistic part of it comes in. Humans everywhere have access to the sky. You know, we all see stars in the sky every night. And there have been cultures that have spent, you know, centuries studying the movements of these, you know, not just astronomically, but in terms of cultural meaning, you know, cultural meaning making, and they've noticed a correlation between our lives and our behaviors and these movements. So it transcends at least cultures, you know. So you can be in the Andes looking at the same sky as, you know, we'll come over the, I don't know, Kazakhstan sometime, you know, so it doesn't matter where you are, what culture we all, and this is just to tie in that animistic piece, you know, that this is a part of our natural world, is what's beyond the earth and what we can see in our sky. And that too has a value, and we are in relationship with it, with that whole cosmos, you know. So this is where I'm bringing in animism, because I feel like astrology has become, over the past couple decades, quite mental. Like you were saying, we've kind of retreated more and more into these isolated mental worlds. But astrology is not a mental thing when it's really understood for what it is. It's like, there are people that can learn astrology just from watching YouTube videos and all of this. But the real way to learn astrology is to spend some time out under the night sky, you know, backpacking, or like you said, being outside, you know, you know, reconnecting with that, oh, that sense of wonder and awe and relational, you know, relationship with it. So that's where that animistic piece comes in. It's like, it's observable. Like you don't have to believe anything. Just go out and watch it. Like when the moon becomes full, we start acting crazy. Like that's observable, you know?
It's that experiential wisdom, right?
Exactly.
That you find in lots of things, but in astrology, I guess you would too as well. And it also makes sense why the two, you know, astrology and animism are so connected, because under the sort of premise of everything is connected, you know, the universe is a whole. It's a single whole being with sort of lots of little various different manifestations that are all connected to each other. And so under that premise, then everything influences everything else to varying degrees, perhaps. And so, yeah, you know, we influence each other, our animals and our plants. We influence them, they influence us. You know, it's all part of a system. And you sort of take that a step up and you go, well, yeah, well, listen, all the stars and planets influence each other too. And so if they're influencing each other and all the planets and everything in them, then that includes us. And so there's no reason to sort of say, oh, well, we're separate, that it doesn't have an influence on us. I mean, you know, it's a very good logical progression to be able to make that connection, right? And it rarely comes to fruition in the experience of it, right? Being outside and in nature and feeling the connection to everything and not necessarily just believing it, right? Because it is easy to just be like, yeah, I believe everything's connected, but it's a different thing to be like, no, like my experience tells me that everything is connected. So I know this is true in my experience, right? What you think, okay, that's your experience, you know? You do your thing, but this is true for me and I don't really mind if you believe it or not, right? Is that, and I guess that's maybe why there's more of a resurgence of it these days. Or what do you think has sort of pushed this resurgence of astrology in the last few years that you've been seeing?
I really don't know, but I'm loving it. I'm loving seeing all these, like, you know, people in their, you know, young 20s, early 20s, you know, picking up astrology. It's really fascinating. I think in some ways, these generations coming up now are just way more open to pretty much everything, you know, and really looking for answers beyond the stale, dry, old stuff they're being fed in textbooks and whatever else, you know. So I don't know why, but I'm really glad it's happening.
No, for sure, it's great. And you know, if I had to sort of guess or think about it, I would think that, you know, because I kind of see that as our sort of Western civilization has developed and we've generally had a much less of a focus on religion and spirituality and much more of a focus on materialism to some degree, but it's not necessarily in a negative sense, but you know, we kind of moved past, or a lot of people are trying to move past the institutionalization of religion, right? Not necessarily the essence of it, but I think that when that happens, people who grow up in it, in those societies, you know, there's no place to find that meaning anymore because it's no longer taught and shared and experienced as cultures. And as you know, it's no one's fault. It's just how things have evolved at this point. And so I think that sort of like spiritual famine, as it's been called, leads people to be like, okay, well, I need meaning and purpose and understanding in my life and I need to find it. And there's lots of different approaches, and maybe people are more hesitant to sort of turn to their own religious upbringings and cultures and experiences because there's this big movement of like atheism and, you know, don't be religious and separate church and state and all these kind of things, which, you know, I'm not placing a value judgment on them. That's just sort of what we see. And so, yeah, and so it's maybe there's this sense of like a lot of people who need meaning in their lives, and even from a very young age, because I think these days, you know, when you're like the way the world is right now, like you're forced to be grown up to a large degree very, very young, right? At least in terms of your exposure to knowledge and ideas. Maybe you don't get it so much when we're young, and it takes a few decades of integration and experience to really master that wisdom. But there is that push and that need for meaning. And I think astrology is one of the ways where it provides that, right? Because it does. Mm-hmm. And it's separate to the sort of religious structures that we have in place today.
Right. Yes. And I think also astrology gives us a certain sense of problem solving, like understanding ourselves in relationship with others, that, you know, we used to get a lot more of that from religion, you know, like, well, if you're a good wife, you do this, you know, like, and now with that, with a lot of those rules sort of breaking down and people being able to be a little bit more authentic, it's like, well, who am I really? You know, or even just how do I, you know, what, why am I always, you know, grouchy in the mornings, or, you know, why, you know, can't I change that? And then I think what astrology gives us is a way to appreciate our unique design in a way that allows us to have those relationships in fulfilling sorts of ways, you know, rather than thinking I should be less grouchy in the morning, you know, or I should, you know, this is what I'm shooting for. Instead of it's more of like a sinking back into, oh, well, no, this is the way I was designed. These are certain things are, yes, and I will try to be less grouchy in the morning, but here, this is how I'm designed. And let me just appreciate, you know, who I am. And if I understand that and love that about myself, I'm going to be a lot nicer person, you know, to pretty much everyone else. And I'm going to be making decisions in a way that is more in harmony and in balance with life, you know, like not trying to be something that I'm not, and really accentuating the things about me that are, you know, the true gifts, the true ways of interacting that benefit the rest of my web of relations, you know.
Right. 100%. And I think it also provides a bridge between that sort of sense of, you know, isolation and loneliness that we were talking about earlier into something that's greater, where, you know, the sort of fear of it being just me and I have to know and do and be responsible for everything, and, you know, what happens if I die, or all that kind of stuff. And it sort of eases a lot of that up because it provides a much bigger picture and a grander idea of, you know, what reality is and how our place in it. Yeah, exactly. And what our place in it is. And I think that lots of people like yearn for that sense, because otherwise you can sort of really easily fall into a nihilistic view of life, and that's not fun, right? Leads to all sorts of, you know, upsetting things.
Yeah, like the opioid crisis, which I feel like is pretty much so many people really just spinning out from the isolated, the sense of isolation. You know, it's easy to see how that would happen. And I think you're right that astrology can give someone a real sense of their place in the rest of everything, so that there is a felt sense of connection. Even if there is loneliness and, you know, isolation, there's a felt sense of meaning, you know, like, why am I alone right now? You know, why do I have to die alone? And, you know, and do I maybe not mind dying alone? Like if I knew that I was connected with everything and I could, you know, be outside and feel that connection, would it feel less lonely?
Right. You know? And not be so afraid of dying and it being the end of you, right? Which I think a lot of people have, understandably, when you come from that place. And I think it also, what it does, like many things, is astrology provides people with a community of like-minded individuals, right? Which is huge, which is also something that is easy to fall out of in the sort of massive societies we live in today, right? Yeah. Where not only are there endless amounts of options of small communities, it's also really difficult to kind of pick and choose and know and make effort, and all that kind of stuff is a big hassle. But, you know, once you kind of fall into one of those communities of any sort, it doesn't have to be religious or spiritual or anything like that. It's just a community of people who are sharing in the love of something, right? And I think that's also something that is hugely important for people always, but especially these days. especially 100% agreed. During the pandemic.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And the benefit of this community of people is it shares a language. You know, mm-hmm. astrology is a language, and the more you can speak it, the more fun it becomes, you know? So like there yeah. is that, there is definitely a really big community and language sharing kind of thing that I think it provides a lot of people.
That's true. There is like a unique language that, and when you have something like that, it's fun to be on the inside, right?
Yeah.
Even if it's just whatever it is, it's like, it's nice to be part of a community that you kind of feel like, oh, these people get it. And I don't have to explain everything, right? And the inside jokes or inside meanings or whatever they are, and mm-hmm. not for the purpose of excluding others, right? Like that's also a point, is like, it's not a elitist thing. It's like, mm-hmm. no, you're welcome to join as well.
Yeah.
Like it's open for everyone, right?
Yeah.
You just have to decide that. It is very interesting. And so, you know, in this book that you wrote, like, I think you touched on, you know, why you wrote it, and you were hoping to explain and show people, you know, the sort of field of what it means to be an agent of evolution, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And to take on that personal responsibility of your managing your own life kind of thing, right? And so how do you sort of like see that in a day-to-day kind of experience? I don't know if that question makes sense.
Mm-hmm, sure. Like the way that I, you know, you said managing your own life, and the way that I refer to it in the book is staying at your evolutionary edge. You know, like I want to, this book will speak to people for whom that is interesting, you know, for people who are interested in like, ooh, well, what's the next, you know, what's the next edge that I can, yeah. you know, get on, you know, get, stay at the edge of. So if somebody has that orientation, then this book gives them a way of engaging, you know, through inquiry, through practice points, through questions, through other people's stories, through some teaching material, through my own stories. It gives people a way of engaging that inquiry, you know, mm-hmm. ongoingly, and from many different viewpoints, you know, from the viewpoint of Venus, from the viewpoint of Mars, so that there are these different doorways into that inquiry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so let's say, for instance, staying at my evolutionary edge in a day-to-day way, today for me has to do with how present can I stay in each moment, which is a kind of a sun orientation, you know, it's about mm-hmm. the presence is a sun sort of thing. So it's a little bit Mars as well, but, and maybe to some degree Mercury, because Mercury is the planet of the mind and speech and language, but the sun is really about our presence. So for me today, on a day-to-day level, you know, how does it show up for me to stay on my evolutionary edge? It's how can I stay in this moment without getting caught up in any of my thoughts or, you know, beliefs or, you know, patterns, like let's say patterns of insecurity or patterns mm-hmm. of doubt, self-doubt, or patterns of, you know, what's the word, when you catastrophizing, yeah. you know?
That's always fun.
That's always, right? That just yeah. takes you out immediately, you know, yeah, like yeah. you're not even present, you know? So how can I stay present? And so I speak about that a little bit in the sun chapter, you know, so that's
yeah.
that kind of a thing. It's about, there are different aspects to our evolution. So it's not just a one size fits all, you know, there are mm-hmm. many different, doorways in, and each of us will have different proclivities, you know, different things we're attracted to. Sure. You know, we're not all going to be Saturn agents of evolution, which is, you know, about doing the thing that nobody wants to do, you know, like doing the heavy lifting on evolution. Not everybody wants to do that. But some people, it is their orientation, you know, and right. we all will at certain points in our lives be asked to do those things, you know, so that's where this book seeks to help you know, people at different stages in their lives with different evolutionary edges at the same time. Yeah.
Sure. And yeah, and just sort of like that whole process of, you know, understanding and exploring like who you are and what this evolutionary edge means for you in your life, right? And it provides this sort of framework to understand that and to navigate it from there, right? And that you can apply it uniquely to yourself and differently to other people. Or, you know, don't worry about other people. Figure out what's on your boat and just go with that, you know?
Yeah. And also understand that it's going to be different at different times, you know? Mm-hmm. Like today, for me, it's a thing about being present in each moment and not getting hijacked by different fears or thoughts, you know? But another day, it might be about increasing my capacity for pleasure, you know, like being able to have fun and really feel that sense of, you know, pleasure and joy, which is a more Venus style path, you know? So it changes. It doesn't, and it can change from minute to minute, you know, but right. Certainly at different times in our lives, you know, maybe month to month, it might be different.
Yeah. And, you know, about knowing how to be okay with that and accepting it, right?
Yeah.
Because that's important too.
Yeah.
Is accepting who you are.
Yeah. Accepting change, you know, accepting, I mean, change is a reality. Central. It's central. Yeah. It's a truth. And so much so for our world today, which is why, you know, these kinds of, I feel like any tools that can help us move through change skillfully.
Yeah.
We need them.
Right. And also, I think just for a last point on that is just that, like, you know, in an evolutionary cycle, it's like big shifts happen at critical moments where things look really rough and it's a tremendously difficult time, right? And, you know, in sort of Darwinian evolution, you either adapt or die, right? And so you can, extrapolating from that, it's like, well, as a world right now, we're going through one of those phases of like a critical point of being like, well, we're either going to get it together and make the changes for the new way and new world and new way of being, or, you know, who knows, it's probably not going to go so well for some people. I don't know, but it's interesting to sort of have that perspective of like difficult times that preeminent change are like a natural part of the cycle, right?
Absolutely.
And that it's okay to go through those things.
Yeah. And truly that, you know, I began writing the book in, I mean, really, I've been writing this book in my head for 10 years, but I feel like what was going on in 2020, even before 2020, in 2019, all astrologers were talking about, oh my Lord, you know, 2020 is big. And so we were, you know, astrologers communities were just having these just conversations ongoingly about, wow, what do you think Jupiter, Saturn, Pluto together means? Like what is your sense of that? You know, very few people predicted a pandemic, but we all kind of knew it was about a huge shakeup, a global shakeup.
Yeah.
So
that's true. I would have been very impressed if someone was like, it's a pandemic. You know, I would have been like, oh shit. I mean,
my teacher actually did, my astrology teacher did predict it. To me, the accurate predictions can only come if we as a culture really start really valuing astrology and we throw as much research and, you know, funding at it as we do toward medicine. Like we're just not at that place right now. Maybe in my, you know, in our kids' lifetimes, that would be true. But there's no doubt that 2019 was a really big moment for me, feeling like this, you know, books like this need to be written because we are heading for massive change and it is part of the cycle and it will, you know, we will come through it in some way or not, but it is a natural, like you were saying, it's a natural part of the cycle and we don't have to freak out about it. We can just understand, okay, this is what we're in for some years.
Yeah, and you don't have to just suffer through it. You can learn to live with the change, right, and embrace it for a much more peaceful life, we'll say. Maybe not happy, but peaceful is a good first step.
Yeah, and maybe content, you know, like, peaceful, content, and in balance, you know, because it, I think change can really throw our lives into imbalance quite dramatically if we're not understanding, you know, what our place in it again. So
yeah, we don't like change, most of us. Our brains tend to resist it quite a lot. We like to know how things are, and when that gets thrown up, it becomes scary and uneasy, and you know, you got to do things you don't want to do and move from your comfort zone, which sucks, but that's life, right? And
that is life.
So yeah, so listen, so where can people find your book? I mean, I'll put links in the description as well, but, you know, please, and where can they find you and your readings, or what would you like to promote to people?
Oh, thanks. Yes. So the book, Agents of Evolution, An Astrological Guide for Transformative Times, it can be found on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble and bookstores near you if you go in and order. If you go in and say, hey, here's the ISBN number. And people can find me at my website, margalauba.com. And all the information about consultations is up there, as well as classes and other offerings that I put out there for my clients, as well as on YouTube. You can find me at Marga Lauba Evolution, and Instagram, Marga_Lauba_Evolution.
Awesome. And you do, you know, like monthly readings, like for generally, and, you know, very interesting stuff. So worth a follow, worth a check out. Go buy your book. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been wonderful. It's been a joy to speak with you, and I hope you'll come on again soon.
Thanks so much for having me, Shane.
All right. Take care.